Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to Baldly Go, the officially unofficial podcast for all of Star Trek. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 2, Episode 6 of Strange New Worlds, Lost in Translation. Aaron, how'd you feel about this Uhura-centric episode?
I like the Uhura eccentricity. Centricity, whatever.
Yes.
I think this, the more Star Trek you've seen, maybe the less impressive this episode is, because this definitely feels like a remix of like themes that have happened again and again and again. Like, you know, we are trying to exploit the resource. It's harming something that we didn't know about. And do we continue the naked acquisition of greed, or do we stop to spare the ecosystem? You know, this is the Horta. This is Data's nanite crystal things from that one report. Like, this happens in Star Trek a lot. And also mixed, I thought, is interesting, because like I thought it's like, wow, we do not see the inside of a nacelle very much at all.
Yes.
And I think this might be the first time. So I did some research. Turns out there's a season 7 episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation called Eye of the Beholder, where Deanna goes into the nacelle because an ensign has committed suicide in there to investigate, and the entire episode is like takes place in the 3 or 4 seconds that a psychic echo of someone who died building the Enterprise in the Utopia Planitia shipyards.
Wow.
The psychic echo was causing people who are empathic to commit suicide whenever they're... So it's like there's this kind of like the idea that something is connecting to a highly empathetic person to get them to, you know, to do something. Like I said, it feels like a lot of remix of Star Trek ideas, but it's fine. It's fine. And like I said, I really liked fleshing out Uhura's character. I like that we're getting a lot of Jim Kirk. I don't know how they're going to continue to have him in the series as much and not feel forced. But so far, they're doing it.
This felt a little forced, but all right, I'll allow it.
A little forced? Why? He's celebrating a promotion with his brother? Like, that's something you do.
Yeah. I don't know. They're out on the edge of the known explored galaxy, and here he is showing up for a meet and greet with his brother on his birthday. Eh.
Yeah.
A little forced. So like I said, with their location, it's a little forced, but whatever.
Bottom line, I think the storyline is okay. Character work, well above average. I like this episode. It's fine. Not great, but it's good. What about you?
Can I ask you, have you ever seen a Bessard ram scoop used?
I have
seen
them flushed.
This might be the first time I've seen that.
Reversed to as a threat display to the, wasn't it the pack lids? We look for things to make us go.
They're stupid enough to think that's a threat, yeah.
Yeah. But no, that was I was excited to see the Bessard ram scoops scooping.
Yeah, me too. I thought it was cool. I don't know, that effect looked really good too, of them kind of opening up and swirling around and scooping in some deuterium.
I thought it was cool.
Here's the thing, I enjoyed this episode. I think it's misplaced. I think this episode belongs in season 1. Like, I know it was very close to the finale. You kind of can't... You needed that finale, but you kind of needed an extra episode in season 1 or to move the death of Himmer around, because it feels much too late to be worried about the death of Himmer so intensely. I think they needed this to follow that much more closely to hit emotionally in the way that they wanted. But other than that, I have very little problems with it. I enjoyed it.
I see what you're saying. I think it's interesting because, like, most of the time, especially in Star Trek, that has very little continuity. If a major character dies, they're going to grapple with it that episode or the next episode, then probably, you know, like, yeah, Tasha Yar dies and they, you know, deal with it. And then the only time they deal with it again is every, every two or three seasons, you remind that Data had a sexual relationship with a human woman, and they pull out the Tasha Yar hologram, and there's your reminder. So like, I kind of think it's cool that they are showing the crew's ongoing mourning, and it's not just one character. That's like Una Chen-Reilly was having problems. Uhura's having problems with it. So I guess I don't mind, but because I was thinking, yeah, it is weird to be in episode 6 and dealing with something that happened in episode 9 of last season. But on the other hand, I'm like, okay, what if this was the first episode? But then, and like, that fucks up better, the La'an with the Kirk, and I really liked the
Right, Kirk, they have a problem with it, these things are so interconnected, right? That's more so than a typical Star Trek episode.
That's the problem with continuity, right?
Yeah.
You actually have to, yeah.
So they kind of had a chicken and egg thing here where I needed Himmer's death to be more fresh in my mind as a viewer to really feel it. But you also needed to set up Pelia. You needed to, like you said, have the La'an Kirk stuff so it would be meaningful and have Kirk there. And like all that stuff needs to happen, but also it needs to be a little closer to the event, I thought. Episode 2, episode 3 maybe?
I think you're saying that, like, this episode felt like it was a little bit assembled from spare Star Trek parts, and, you know, I think you talking about the pacing overall of the season, that we've had some, like, really interesting sci-fi takes I haven't seen before. We've seen some action-packed episodes, seen some hilarious character work, and this one just kind of felt like, it's an episode.
Yeah, and, I like the universal translator angle of this, where they're comparing it to that, and it's... It's not so much like a direct empathic communication like you would get with Deanna Troi, but it's like using your own memories to try and convey something. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, or you're conveying an emotional payload, and then your brain tries to interpret that in the way it makes sense for you. I thought that's solid, yeah.
It was neat, and I'm sure it's something that's also been done several times in Star Trek before, but I don't remember it, so it was kind of fresh to me.
Yeah. It's no Darmok at Jalad when the walls fall, but it's not Jalad, it's Darmok at, is it Jalad?
And Jalad at Tanagra, yeah.
At Tanagra when the walls fell.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, no, like I said, it's fine. It's not the worst episode of Star Trek I've ever seen. It's not the best episode.
Of course.
That's Star Trek sometimes.
Star Trek
also,
most of the time.
Also, we're kind of like burying the lead. The climactic meeting of James T. Kirk and Spock happened, and what do you think about that? Because that's another thing where this episode's kind of leaving me cold, because it's a moment and they treat it as such, but it's kind of like a nothing moment.
Yeah, yeah. What was the rest of the episode earning that? No, I. It feels like a tacked on thing, but it should be this momentous thing, and they try and play it that way, and I didn't feel it. And that's not even true. They do a good job in that scene, but it's just one scene in an episode that has roughly nothing to do with that.
Well, these are like two of the most hollowed characters in Star Trek canon, and the fact that they just meet at a bar, you know, talking over the denouement of Uhura's episode is like, I thought that they would be, I always thought that they would be butting heads, you know, that they would, they're such a wild mix of characteristics that would take them a while to fully appreciate. Now of course you come to the bar and like, I don't know that Jim Kirk is the type of guy that's like, hey, I'm a Vulcan. Ah, you logical bastard, I'm a man of passion and emotion. Punch him in the face. But like, I kind of wanted, you know, a mission that would that would show that they have these very different approaches. But I don't know, maybe they have a meet cute and then they have to work together in a later season, a later episode. I hope a later season. And they do have, because like I that's what my impression, that they always had, it was something that wasn't like an easy friendship, right? I think that leads to some of the best friendships, is like when you have to overcome like a difference of opinion, a difference of culture, difference of lifestyle. So yeah, I just thought it was kind of a weird, kind of like, hey, look, Spock and Kirk shaking hands. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It felt like too big of a moment to be given the treatment it got. But we'll see. There's time, you know, they could do an episode with them having the relationship.
Well, it's one of those things where there's only so many big moments that this show can have in terms of, like, you know, us meeting people for the first time. And, you know, there's a couple, like Scotty is a big one. You know, we've had a revolving chief engineer. Eventually we're going to get McCoy, I imagine, like towards the end of the series. I don't know if they're actually going to go all the way to that era of Star Trek. But like, there's only so many, and like, we've gotten through, like, we've already met Kirk.
Mm-hmm.
See him sitting in captain's chair.
It felt like a big episode for Kirk and Uhura, for sure. I just don't know if they needed to tack on the Spock stuff yet. Kind of, yeah. I wish they would have given that its own episode.
Yeah. We should probably talk about this episode.
Yeah, let's get into the recap. Set phasers to add. We'll be right back.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Captain on Bridge, welcome back to Baldly Go. We start off with a comms officer log from Uhura, who says the Enterprise is going to a nebula where there's a deuterium mining operation. Starfleet's trying to get off the ground. It's had some problems. On the bridge, Uhura's tired. Spock suggests they refuel by collecting some of that deuterium since they're here. And they do, and then Uhura hears a signal that seems like she can't replicate it, which is strange. There's no recording of it. Just kind of in her head. I also didn't mention that Pike has got to upgrade temporarily to fleet captain, and they make some noise about that.
Yeah, he's got a new shiny insignia. His communicator now has a black circle around it, which I suppose indicates that he's captain of the fleet. Yeah. And it's like, you know, he's like, yeah, fleet. I got the Farragut and this gas station at my command and disposal. And I'm going to end up destroying one of my commands by the end of this episode. But
And they're going to take it away from me as soon as the mission's over. So don't get too excited.
Nice to see a non-personal log entry from a Starfleet officer to begin the episode. Like, we've had so many personal fucking logs where this is business. We're doing some business this episode.
Yeah. And they talk about the importance of this particular location, how it could be a jumping off point for the next great age of exploration, and it's also pretty close to Gorn space, which that was a plot point they brought up. They were worried about the Gorn kind of encroaching and getting closer and something coming their way from Gorn space, and they have kind of dropped that until now. This is the second mention we've had of it.
No, I'm glad. Like, if Gorn's the big bad, like, you know, they made a big impression last season, I think that could be cool. But like, also in prototypical Starfleet fashion, they're trying to, you know, say like, oh, we're here because this is at the frontier of exploration, and it's going to unlock a quarter of the whole quadrant. And then someone's like, also, isn't it close to Gorn space? Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, that's we might have to go. But it's like, you know, the Federation's the classic, you know, to if you want peace, prepare for war kind of thing. Feel like they're Pacem Bellum or whatever the fuck John Wick Latin applies here. I feel like they're doing that. They're preparing for war.
Mm-hmm. There's also the scene where they bust open the Bessard collectors and
the Bessard tubes, man. Fucking love it. Someone's read the technical manuals and were as excited to see. And it's so, like, I guess we should say this for fans that don't know. For the longest time, it's been established in technical jargon and lore and episodes like the Paclids, where they reverse flushed the deuterium through the scoops and made this big red mist appear in front of the Enterprise as a fake weapon. to scare someone away without killing them. But the idea is like that the Enterprise is self-sufficient. It if it needs to, if it runs out of its gas, its deuterium fuel, it can use these Bessard scoops that use magnetic fields to funnel interstellar hydrogen isotopes into the collector that can then go to the main engine. And there's also a process where they can turn matter into antimatter by applying some kind of unknown physical force to reverse the polarity of the matter. So like the Enterprise, and it, they always mention it, this is like emergency survival. You'll be you cannot collect enough fuel like to top off your tanks, and certainly the antimatter part. But like it's something I always thought that was cool, that like there's no way for an Enterprise to actually run out of gas as long as it's got propulsion. And it's near a hydrogen rich enough place, I guess.
And it doesn't go too fast through the cloud of deuterium, because makes a point that they can use more fuel than they gain, which okay.
So I've been wanting to see this since I was like 13 years old. Super cool to see finally.
Yeah. Then Uhura goes to nacelle. I forget which nacelle. The port nacelle, maybe. I can't remember. To recalibrate the communications array with some help from recordings that Himmer made with her. Pelia tries to strike up a conversation, but Uhura is busy, so she only gives her the most basic of attention, and she goes back to watching Himmer fondly in this scene. She's watching Uhura tube. This very much felt like Himmer's series on how to maintain port nacelles or communication systems.
Yeah, no, it turns out that's exactly what it is. No, it's great. I thought Himmer was one of my favorite characters last season. I was sad to see him go, and I was actually kind of happy to see, you know, him back and because I'm with you. It never really sat. In fact, did I not say this in episode one or two that never quite sat well with me that they just moved on from Himmer. So like given like, you know, this episode of having like a few of the crew, you know, kind of check in how they're feeling about him, I thought it was appropriate.
Yeah.
And he makes for a terrifying zombie, turns out.
Oh yeah.
I thought the nacelle control room was also a really cool set. Mm-hmm. I love like how you can just tell like the red window in the front, that's the one that points the scoop, and then you see the big warp coils is going on in an endless hallway, that's the nacelle. It's like, I don't know, I think that's cool, the idea that you ride an elevator to the top of this pylon and boom, here's where the magic happens. Super cool.
Yeah, this set very much felt to me more like the original series than any of the sets that we see. It didn't quite have the sleekest of updates, like, you know, all the bridge and conference rooms and corridors and stuff do. So I don't know, maybe that's just me, but it felt more like the original series.
Yeah, no, I can see it.
All right, let's go to Pike and Una talking about why the Enterprise was sent to get the refinery operational. It's apparently had some logistical problems. Then Uhura gets in a turbo lift and sees a zombified Himmer snapping at her. Difficulties. I think by the end we're going to understand that it wasn't organizational. It was obviously aliens.
Yeah. I was shocked at the zombie Himmer. I thought that worked really well. I thought he's scary. It's unexpected. What the fuck is happening? I mean, I knew it was a vision, but I was like, you know, where is this going? And he looks great.
Is this a memory that Uhura has of a zombified Himmer snapping at her in a turbo lift?
You know, that's the one thing it doesn't track, right? Like, if they're But I wonder if there's some kind of like, you know, you can't kill me in any way that matters kind of thing going on. Because I don't think these like my impression is these aliens are higher dimensional beings that, you know, are pushing through our space and we're unable to perceive them because they're, you know, but they're still physical beings and they're entangled in our matter. So when we're scooping parts of it out to throw through our engines, it's not killing them. It's just sending them in extreme pain, or it's diminishing them or something. I think that's them trying to you know, like if you beam that idea that like, well, you're not killing us necessarily, but you're hurting us. But no, they people are dying. Yeah, I don't
yeah,
know.
They're,
you're
they're
right.
definitely killing them in some capacity. I mean, that's what Uhura says later.
Because all the other visions, when she walks us through it at the end of the episode, I think they do tie to the thoughts and, you know, the definitions are trying to beam into her brain. But yeah, zombie Himmer, what the hell was that?
Maybe just a wake up call. Just like get her attention, right?
Yeah.
It's a pretty intense image.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's, yeah, definitely got her attention for sure.
Mm-hmm. So then Uhura gets an examination from Mbenga, who thinks she has deuterium poisoning and needs some sleep as well. So he takes her off duty to get rest. She's been working herself to the bone, I think, to avoid thinking about Himmer, right? And her family and all the stuff that's coming back.
That's
up.
Her strategy is to, you know, conceal and push all those feelings down so she doesn't have to deal with them.
Yeah. And Pelia kind of points that out later and not to Uhura's face, but to Una. She's talking about, you know, these reminders that that she's giving her.
And Pella, I don't know if we talked about this, but like Pella was talking to Uhura because she's like, you know, what the hell are you doing in my Nacella room? And she explained it and she's like, why haven't you talked to me? So this is kind of like a Pella episode in that she is, I mean, she's been around long enough. She knows exactly what's going on, but she's trying to lead the crew to the realization that they need so they can get on with their professional relationship. And I thought, I don't have any problem, Pelly. Is you warming up to her yet? Or is she still?
Nope.
Nails on chalkboard.
Yeah. Right. Sorry. Still not doing it for me.
What is it? Is the accent?
It's the whole demeanor. Maybe I'm an Una here, but she's sloppy and she's kind of annoying. I don't know. It's everything about her, honestly.
She's thousands of years old. I think you would get a little sloppy. You'd learn a different, like, you know, like you'd have your own ideas of what is important, what's not important, and no genetically modified 40-year-old whippersnapper is going to tell you. And I also thought that even if you don't like her approach, like Una's approach of, you know, like, well, we're just going to fix, just deal with the problem in front of me. We see the weakness of that, too, because she wasn't seeing the bigger picture. So,
no,
like,
Pelia's
I don't know. I feel
right.
like it was a...
It's just everything about her demeanor.
She's an asshole.
Look, I'm not a thousand... Maybe she acts like a thousand-plus-year-old, multi-thousand-year-old being, and I should know that. I'm not thousands of years old. Not yet, anyway. Mm-hmm. So I'm not handling it very well.
Fair enough.
Call me Una, but that's how I feel. Speaking of Una, she's in charge of fixing the refinery, and Pelia's out there with her, and she's got some teams working on it, but Pelia comes up and says, I think there's some underlying issue that we haven't figured out yet, and Una's like, you know what? Just go do what I told you to do. I don't know that she gives her direct orders here. She says later, you disobeyed a direct order. I never picked up on a direct order, but okay. There were probably prior direct orders.
I agree. Like, he's saying it's like, the issues will come to light as we fix the under... Like, I think that's, like, you could extrapolate that, like, your commanding officer doesn't want you to do this, but, like, a direct order...
Yeah. Words
usually
mean
preceded
things,
by words like, I'm giving you a direct order, you know, like, when you're wanting to do it, like, court-martial things, like,
I don't know.
You have
to say that's an order.
Yeah,
you have to say it for it to be a direct order. You can
and
say
really
an implied
like,
order.
I really like, because like sometimes in Star Trek episodes, the A and B plot don't connect at all. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just literally on two parallel tracks. But I always like it when they do connect. I really like it when you feel like you've got an A, B plot that are not connected, that are deeply connected. And I think they did a good job of like showing in the margins of like, you know, like there's this mystery. Like why is a starbase running behind? You know, is this like and then you see Pella, who's is a smart engineer, saying like this stuff is breaking faster than we can fix it. And the idea that like these deuterium beings are sabotaging the works and like gumming it up because they're desperately trying to stop it. And efficient Starfleet trying to fix things as fast as they break. I liked it because like, you know, you are more than halfway through the episode before you see how these things connect. And I thought that was pretty good.
And the core of why Una's acting the way she is ties back to the same feelings that Uhura's having with Himmer, right? Like she reminds him of the dead engineer. I think emotionally and plot-wise it connects.
And it's also like I like that Pella is fighting for her position on the ship, you know, like she sees that they are not really accepting her. So instead of like meekly trying to, she's tackling the bull head on, like, you are going to acknowledge your feelings and get over it. And then, you know, if you want to hate me for good reasons to hate me, fine. But like, let's not pretend it's because I gave you a C+ on your shitty engineering report, Una, or
yeah.
You know, you just haven't had time, Uhura. Like, I like a person who is direct like that.
Quickly, Uhura can't sleep because she's having nightmares in hearing the signal. I think this is the scene where she's seeing kind of a glimpse of the shuttle memory that we don't know what it is yet. There's just kind of fire in the distance, and she's out in the field.
Yeah, there's a forest on fire, but it's, yeah, as you go in the episode, you'll appreciate that this is her shuttlecraft that killed her entire family, her mom
apparently,
and dad at least.
Did we have any hint of that in prior episodes, or was this the first we were learning?
I don't, because again, I was watching season one more as a fan, and yeah. I don't know, but...
I think this is the first I remember hearing of it, and it's kind of surprising that, you know, the person she talks about this with is... basically a stranger. I mean, it's James Kirk. It's not one of her friends here on board the Enterprise. Kirk has a way of kind of getting in there with people, right?
Yeah, I like how they are fleshing out younger Kirk. He's still brash, but he's a lot more like open and outgoing in a kind neighborly way than I would suspect from Captain James T. Kirk, who's a little bit more aloof and, you know, might, you know, not check in emotionally with every crew member that he sees.
Uh-huh.
But also, her is an attractive woman, so maybe that's
that helps on. Yeah, that's one point on James Kirk's scoreboard for sure.
Yeah, like some dude in Sam's science department's lying bleeding in the corridor, and just Kirk steps right over, but.
Uh-huh.
Same crewman in a miniskirt. I'm sorry. Yeah. Do you need assistance?
For sure. Speaking of James Kirk, boom, he beams aboard. Here he is. He's met by his brother Sam, and they go to the bar. Sam's feeling inferior because of. I'm gonna call him Kirk. I'm gonna call James Tiberius Kirk Kirk, and yes. I'm gonna call Sam Kirk Sam.
How I have in my notes.
He has not earned the name Kirk in my mind.
No. He's shaming the name Kirk, obviously.
Yeah, yeah, his anthropology. Get out of here. Get out of here with your studies. Yeah, Sam's feeling inferior because of Kirk's recent promotion to first officer of the Farragut, youngest ever first officer. Same post, I think, as his father. Or no, his father held the record previously for
he's
youngest.
He's the previously
officer,
youngest Starfleet officer to make first officer, and it's making Sam, and I think Sam's got a point here because it's mm-hmm. always kind of bothered me that Starfleet talks about how they're exploration first, they're not a military organization, but you look at what they value in terms of like people they promote. It doesn't seem like, you know, have you ever seen a science officer captaining a starship? I guess you have to go to command it. So it's like it's what Starfleet values, their core values versus what they promote seems like, you know, they like that cowboy. They like that person that kind of mm-hmm. goes out and breaks things and fucks shit up. And
yeah, especially
like
out
Sam,
on the frontier, right?
Yeah, who is
a guy who's
doing the hard work.
Able to handle any situation that might arise. And
yeah.
Maybe science officers aren't qualified for that. I don't know.
I feel like that there should be some kind of like parallel track that you have, like that, you know, like you can't command a starship maybe, but why couldn't you have the rank of captain? Like, why isn't the chief science officer on Star Trek a rank of captain? And, you know, mm-hmm. maybe as third or fourth in command of the Enterprise. I think they have that with like the Beverly, like, is because it wasn't Beverly. It's like she was in the chain of command, I thought. Maybe not.
She might have been. I mean, Spock ends up captaining the Enterprise many times, right? When Kirk's doing other things,
and
or like when he's away.
He
or
definitely came up in the sciences.
Yeah, he's a science officer. So I think you can get pretty close, but it seems like command is where you want to be for sure if you want to captain a starship.
Yeah. Yeah.
But and then on TNG, I mean, you've just got two command officers in line. It's like...
Also, it might, like, it's also, I imagine, frustrating to have, like, a really highly functional, ambitious sibling, because, like, even, like, you know, if it's easy to think, like, God damn, if this guy was never born, everyone would love me because I'm doing so well. But they're just doing better. And it sounds like the Kirk's dad is kind of an asshole who is giving all the love and the sunlight to the James over Sam. That's not good. So yeah, Sam's got a lot of good reasons to be jealous.
Yeah, I'm also sympathetic to Kirk's point. Like, look, I just did the thing the dad was going to be most proud of. Am I to blame for that? Like, you went and did your science thing, and that's fine. I went and did the command cowboy thing, but that's what dad likes. How can I be blamed for him liking the things he likes about me?
Yeah.
And having ambition. Like, it has nothing to do with Sam, really.
Like I said, I understand Sam being jealous and Sam thinking this is unfair, but I also think that it's ridiculous to think that Kirk has to apologize.
Yeah, and Kirk's not very diplomatic about it, right? He says, oh, well, why didn't you do the same things I did instead of wallowing in a science in a lab?
Yeah,
and
I'm like, that was
a bad choice of words, man.
See, that's making me think that, like, maybe he's showing signs of that, his dad's personality, and maybe that's why he's more the guy he is in later Star Trek. But, I wonder if we'll get an episode, you know, like, we eventually met Riker's father. He had the difficult relationship. I wonder if we'll get, like, I think that'd be a fun episode. Sam, Jim, and their dad. Seeing their dynamic as brothers with their dad. I think that'd be a cool episode. And it might change my mind about this whole situation. Because maybe Sam's got more of a point than I think. Because it could be that Kirk plays into that a little bit. You know, there's ways as a sibling I think you can help, like, you know, diffuse some of these family tensions. And there's definitely ways as a sibling you can inflame them. And I'd give even odds about which one Kirk is at this point.
I want to see Sam and his dad joust American Gladiator style. That's what I want. Riker.
Yeah,
and his dad.
The Riker method.
Yeah, work it all out, boys. Work it out on the aggro crag or whatever.
What was that sport they were playing? Was that the Parisi squares? It's not Ractigino. That's the
coffee.
That's the gambling game. Oh, is it?
No, Dom
Jot.
That's
the drink.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Dom Jot is the game. Gambling. Ractigino is the drink. Okay. I definitely...
I don't know Parisi Squares. That might be what they were playing. I can't remember.
Because I remember there's, like, one episode where, like, they all had shore leave at a star base, and, like, Worf and Tasha were wearing, like, 24th century sports outfits, and Riker's like, where are you going? There's a Parisi Square Championship. Or maybe... I don't know. I could be remixing things. But yeah,
possibly.
American Gladiator Q-tip battle between the Kirks. It's penciled in season 3.
Perfect. So the systems are coming online and over on the refinery, and Pelia says, we found something in one of the functioning systems, and I had to take it offline because it points to sabotage.
Beastie Boy, strike again.
Yeah, right? Yeah, we'll get to more of this here in a second, because this is just kind of the setup for what comes later. Then Chapel and Spock are playing 3D chess while they try and define their relationship.
4D chess. Oh, no, it is 3D chess.
It's 3D, yeah.
Wait, well, we play 3D chess.
We do play 3D chess, technically, but on a 2D board. Right? So the board is 3D. The chess, I mean, all chess is inherently 4D, because without time, you can't move pieces.
Yeah,
so
I guess that's true.
5D chess? I don't know what they're playing.
I was trying
anyway
to think of, like, what is that canonically called on Star Trek? Is it?
I think it's 3D
chess.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Chess.
But yeah, they're playing 3D chess, and they're
talking about their relationship, trying to define it through a quantum superposition metaphor. Christine kind of wants to just let it be whatever it is for now without telling anybody. And if Spock, and she's kind of getting annoyed that, like, Spock is being his logical self. I wonder if she would rather have human Spock back in this moment to have this chat.
Or is there the idea that, like, maybe she thinks Spock is being a little too possessive and clingy? Like, wanting to define her, like we just
rushing
fucked
into
last
it,
night.
Maybe.
You're wanting to define the relationship. You want, like...
Yeah.
And also, maybe she's also scared that if they tell Starfleet that there'll be some kind of, you know, But I don't know. Also, yeah. Like, is there the awareness that she's kind of a bit of a, not exactly like a homewrecker because they're on a break, but like the fact that she is splitting up a relationship and she wants to, you know, before we make this all official, like maybe we should, I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of complexity to this.
There's a weird cold off-puttishness about Chapel in this scene, I thought.
She's also trying to beat him at chess.
True.
So maybe she's just distracted from both things.
Right.
But yeah, you're right. I felt like it was so hot and heavy at the end of last episode that it's kind of surprising that that's been turned down a notch here.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, the marriage is a huge complication, right? The potential future engagement, because it could be back on at some point.
Well, they could play, because I've always thought of Spock always coded conservative to me, you know, like most Vulcans are. Like, they respect history and tradition and doing things correctly and by the books. And I think that extends to their love life too. And so, like, you see and it could be that the Nurse Chapel's more of like, yeah, I love you. I don't know, we like boning, but like, I don't know if we have to label it a thing. And and it feels like there's a little tension of her wanting a little, you know, maybe that's kind of like, now that this is actually happening, it's not like, oh, Spock's my cool space boyfriend. It's like, oh God, is he wanting to pond fire me up? And am I gonna have to mind meld with his mother-in-law? That seems like a fucking nightmare.
Oh,
like, it's
God.
Like, it's just, maybe it's feel like it's going too fast. I couldn't quite figure out exactly the vibe, but it's something.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I'm with you. And then Uhura shows up, and Chapel and Spock, she tells Chapel and Spock that she doesn't think she has deuterium poisoning because she heard the signal before her exposure to the deuterium. Chapel says, you should probably sleep, but that's the last thing she wants to do. So she goes to the bar where Kirk tries to strike up a conversation, and she is not in the mood. I'm going to take it all the way to the commercial here, the commercial break. When she gets in the corridor, she sees a bunch of dead people and herself, who promptly attacks her, and she swings on herself and comes to with Kirk on the floor with a busted nose. Commercial break.
A lot to like here. I like that the payoff of Kirk being a chess genius, where across the room he diagnosed that Spock was just two moves away from checkmate.
Mm-hmm. From getting checkmated, right?
Yeah. And also, yeah. Like, Uhura trying to fend off James T. Kirk, and he's doing the whole, like, hey, I'm not flirting. I'm just, like, which I think at this stage of Kirk's development might be genuine. Like I think that, like, a guy
maybe.
Like Kirk is so successful with women that, like, if women, if a woman comes up and says, clearly puts him on the friend off ramp, I think he's cool with that. Like, okay.
Yeah, there's always another round.
I've invited 17 girls today, just today, to join me at Starbase for drinks.
And
so,
15 of them accepted. So.
Right. So, like, okay, yeah, I don't need a 60. I'll just be friends. And also, like, the thing is like, I think he is a genuine friend to her in this episode. Like, he never tries to take things romantic. He, you know, shows concern for her.
Because he knows it gets
after
socked
her.
If he does.
Yeah, no, I think he's a pretty stand. He seems like he's trying to be a stand up guy, and a guy like Kirk,
yeah,
I guess, could afford. You know, he's not Kirk, because what Kirk is not desperate.
No.
I think more than anything, that's the unnerving thing when you're dealing with the dude at a bar. It's like someone that feels like there's a whiff of desperation about him, and you just never get that with Kirk.
I'm disappointed in the ending of this scene right before the commercial break, because Uhura comes to, sees that she has decked Kirk, and his line is not nearly as good as it could have been. He should have said something like, now who's hitting on who, right?
Yeah, they play it straight, like it kind of like a mild outrage of like, I said I wasn't trying to hit on you, but yeah,
right? But he got hit, and I feel like there's a pun here to be had, and they don't go for it, and I was disappointed.
I didn't sense its absence, but now that you pointed out, yeah, they left some things on the table.
Yeah,
where's the
wit and charm of Kirk? Come on.
Yeah.
Maybe that hasn't developed yet quite as much.
Just a lieutenant. Almost a commander.
Then we come back from commercial, and Uhura apologizes for punching Kirk. And Here's where I was worried that things were, that, you know, Kirk's intentions weren't genuine here, because she takes him back to her quarters to patch him up. And I'm thinking, where's this going? But Kirk, you know, nothing untoward. He tries to help her figure out what's happening to her and takes her medical record to the Farragut to see if anyone else has had some similar experiences lately.
Yeah.
Our dermal regenerator is kind of like the Band-Aids of the future, because she just kind of has one in her quarters.
It must be, yeah, something
like,
that you can...
I cut myself, you know, slicing onions or whatever with pike. Guess I'll bust out the dermal regenerator.
There's probably something, just like, you know, Band-Aids don't, you know, like if you get a deep enough cut or a big enough abrasion, like Band-Aids don't cut, you should probably go see to the emergency room, you know. But a broken nose, I actually thought that was kind of him looking out for her, because, like, you know, it's like, hey, instead of going to the sick bay and trying to... You'll fill out paperwork on why you assaulted a superior officer. Why don't we just, you know... But you're right. That could have been very ulterior motive, and good on Kirk for not exploiting that.
It felt like a potential setup to try and get in her pants, but...
That'd be the last thing Uhura needed in this episode.
Oh, yeah. So then Una and Pelia go to the source of the sabotage and find a Starfleet officer just freaking out, talking about... You're not real. This isn't real. Una calls in a medical emergency. We find out this guy's name is Lieutenant Ramon.
I got nothing. That's exactly what happened.
Okay, cool.
Let's accurate summary of the scene.
Next scene, Uhura sees a vision of the Enterprise being attacked and the bridge crew being sucked out into space. And she comes to on the bridge with Pike telling her she's supposed to be on medical leave. And that, I mean, it's pretty obvious that this is not actually happening, right? Like, they go so big with this vision. I don't know. I kind of knew instantly that it wasn't real.
Or her not getting blown out to space was my first big tip off. But yeah.
I mean, anybody getting blown out to space was my tip off, because... They're not going to kill Pike and Spock in a random attack where, I mean, they literally can't kill Spock. So
true. I think that I really like the conceit of, like, them, you know, kind of starting a scene and you think that she's doing this, she's sleeping in her cab, or she's this, and then they find that you know, she's in the middle of a vision.
Yeah.
I like that they did that two or three times, and like I said, it's not like they're pulling the wool over you, but it's cool. It's cool. It makes you feel a little off balance, unsure of yourself, like you might be going crazy too. And I always enjoy when they put you in those positions. You know, there's like that classic episode where the universe is shrinking around Beverly. You know, at first it's like, yeah, maybe there's something wrong with me, maybe something wrong with the ship, and it's like something wrong with the universe, and but like also no one else around, you know, it's that stuff adds a lot of psychological spice to the episode, and I think they pulled off real well here.
Yeah. And then Pike takes her aside and he's gonna talk about what's going on. Kirk comes in, says he heard about Ramon, and the Farragut had a call about him as well. So there was definitely something going on with him.
Why does Kirk go on the bridge to say this?
Why doesn't he just, like, hit a communicator and talk to Pike over that? Is that what you're asking?
Because he's doing all this on Uhura's behalf, right? That's why he was checking into this stuff. But I just don't know why Una Chin Riley didn't, like, instantly say, hey, we found someone sabotaging the thing, since you're the fleet captain. Like, why does Kirk is the first to know? But I don't know. It wasn't clear to me, other than the writers wanted Kirk to hook back up with Uhura through the episode, that, like, why he would be the one to barge onto the bridge and be like, I don't even serve on this ship, but got some important information.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly, but
might have come from the Farragut too.
I'm gonna say, yeah, I think Ramon might have been from the Farragut. And so his medical records on the Farragut were what tipped Kirk's hand.
But
and then
Pike's
he
first
and
officer is the one that found him, and Pike is the fleet captain. Like, the chain of command, like, how did Kirk find out about it and then sprint? Like, he's off, presumably on shore leave or some kind of, like, leave visiting his brother on his ship, and he just sprint, like, you know, like, I don't know. Just it seemed a little out of place for me.
He did an emergency transport to right outside of the doors.
Sure.
This is how he earns his youngest first officer ever titles, right? Like, yeah, he's using emergency transporters left and right.
Not by walking the decks, you're not.
No,
Yeah. Yeah, you gotta steal some of that time back.
Mm-hmm. He's got zero steps, but he's got that insignia. Anyway, yeah. Uhura starts wondering if any of this stuff is real, because they take Ramon to Mbenga, who says speech centers of his brain are fucked, and he tries to scan him, and Ramon attacks him and runs off, and she's freaking out, and then Kirk tells her, look, this is all real, and they go after Ramon.
Yeah, he viciously attacked Mbenga, like sliced his chest wide open.
Yeah, Mbenga's like, doctor, heal thyself, no problem, I got this, it's a flesh wound.
Give me the subdermal regenerator. Uh-huh. I did think it was wild. The security just starts firing what looks like lethal shots at him. Those did not look like stun.
No, they're causing all kinds of sparks on the frame. And God, they're a terrible shot.
And that's the thing. It's like, it's one thing if you want to argue in the 21st century where all we have is guns, apparently, that you get a mental health call and someone's got a knife and, you know, they do something aggressive, you start opening up on. But this is fucking Star Trek, where they can turn force fields on, like, individual hallway segments. It's insane to me that the security officer just opened up on this guy. I get it. He assaulted an officer with a knife. He's a dangerous guy. But, like, you could lock a transporter beam him right to the brig, throw a force field on him, set a fucking phaser to stun, you know.
Yep. I'm trying to remember. So my mind is tainted by the experience of TNG and Deep Space Nine era, where they can track people in the ship based on their communicator signals, and they know where you are at all times, lock onto you with the transporter. Do they have that capability in the original series? I don't remember.
That's a good question, whether they're that kind of precision.
Because if they do, all of this is pointless. Like, this whole chase for Ramon across the ship, they should have just transported, like you said, right into the brig. Yeah. No harm, no foul.
But he's in eyesight. Like, you could just, like, you know, say, hey, shut down this corridor. Boom. But,
he might have ripped off his communicator. I don't know. Oh, it's not
also,
even a communicator.
Well, they're not communicators.
Yeah.
I was about to say, it's like, the thing is, yeah.
TNG, man, it's messing with me.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
I also like Uhura not knowing whether it's real or not. She's like, is this any of this really happening? Because it's like, yeah, what the fuck?
So Pike hunts Ramon and finds a dead body in his wake. The power gets cut and Pike thinks Ramon's headed toward engineering. So they kind of follow him. And Uhura is also hunting Ramon and she begins seeing things again. This time it's the corridor closing in on her. And Kirk's there to kind of snap her out of it. And she says, I'm going to go back to sick bay. Don't bother coming with me. Just keep hunting for Ramon. But she does not go back to sick bay.
Why does she lie? Because I took
maybe
it.
Maybe she's on her way back to sick bay when she, because she's doubling back, right? And then later they say, oh, Ramon must have hid and we passed him. So maybe she's doubled back. And just
but
on
she's,
her
why
way
would
to sick
she
bay.
Head? I don't think you can just accidentally wind up by the main nacelle access when you're wandering back to your crew quarters from sick bay. And the way she, like, maybe she's just being cautious, but like the way she goes away from Kirk with the gun, phaser drawn, flashlight in the hand, like it seems like she was still in hot pursuit. And I think that she had an idea that he would be drawn to the nacelle room. I'm not sure why, but that's my like, I think she had a hunch, and maybe it was because the aliens themselves are doing some kind of mental directing. I don't know, but it could be that she was just heading back and just saw the blood and decided to, but like, I don't know. It felt like she's
cautious.
Shaking. It felt like she's shaking Kirk to me.
Yeah, a little bit, based on the way it was filmed. Anyway, Pike and Lon run into Kirk and they decide to double back, thinking that he hid somewhere behind them, like I said. And then Uhura finds blood near an access hatch and calls in Ramon's location. She goes through the hatch and finds Ramon tampering with a console. She tries to talk some sense into him, but it doesn't work, and he starts a sequence that results in the nacelle exploding. Luckily, Kirk is there just in time to beam himself and Uhura out before they die.
It's funny because the outside... Okay, I got two problems here. Number one, this fucker freezes solid to like he's cracking, like the T-1000 dipped in liquid nitrogen.
Which, as
like
we all know, happens seconds. The moment you go into space. Freeze.
Star Trek, do better. Yeah, because like, that's not how any of this works. You don't freeze solid.
Your eyes come out of your head. I've seen Total Recall. I know what happens.
Sure. Now, they did that. That's based on science. It's freezing stuff, not. The second thing is, when you see the outside shot of Lieutenant Ramon,
yeah,
getting blown out to space, it looks like that whole fucking nacelle is going up in flames.
Yeah.
I don't know how the Enterprise is, like, not completely stricken, has to limp back to Starbase kind of thing. Maybe it's like an engine backfiring and... You know, all that, like, the explosion came out the side vents that apparently you can open up, and it's not as bad. But, man, it looked like the whole nacelle was going up.
Yeah, totally.
Maybe that's the Pella can just do out in deep space, you know?
Maybe they transplant one of the Farragut's nacelles and strand Kirk out there. They're like, look, hey, we're the flagship. We got to get going, man.
I'm the fleet captain. I got places to be. Give me your nacelle. Yeah.
Because that doesn't take long to swap out, I'm sure.
Also, it's the exact same size and shape. He just got going around with one. Oh, no, he takes both. He wants a match set.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Otherwise, he'd be lopsided.
Yeah.
You might just do donuts when you go into warp, right?
Yeah, you don't want to do warp donuts. That's not good.
No. Use up all your deuterium.
Give the Milky Way a yard job in subspace.
Just kicking stars all over the place.
Yeah, yeah. I fuck your stellar nursery. Red alert, here comes an ad break.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy. Woo! And sadness. Oh. And anger. Definitely some disgust.
Rose.
And I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
It's the 40th anniversary of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom this week. And while the movie might be old enough to belong in a museum, our podcast is brand new. So join us for a conversation on the third or fourth best Indiana Jones movie, depending on who you ask, this Wednesday.
And if retro adventure movies aren't your thing, well, maybe you'll enjoy a time warp in the form of a prequel with the theatrical release of Furiosa. Flashback with us to a time when Charlize Theron looked like Anna Taylor-Joy. And strap in for another epic George Miller action movie this Thursday on Bald Move Pulp.
And finally, we're wrapping up our 4-week coverage of the 1980 TV miniseries Shogun. Get the final verdict on Yabu, JB, Mariko, and the rest of the gang this Thursday on Bald Move Prestige.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Let's boldly go back to the episode. Welcome back to Baldly Go.
Uhura then asks Pike to confine her to quarters, thinking she's going to end up like Ramon. He doesn't think it'll come to that. He's pretty laissez-faire about this whole thing, considering the cell just exploded.
Pike is insane for this. Like, confine her to quarters? I don't see any problem with that. If you don't want to do that...
requesting it, yeah.
Assign her a medical staff to just follow her. It's like, hey, if she starts wigging out or doing anything wild, you know, here's a hypo spray, apply it to the neck. Like, the fact that you're just letting... we saw another... Ramon killed a person.
Two people.
Well, and himself. Right. Was some of that person in a body bag... was that... No, that was Ramon. Okay, because I was wondering how many people were in the nacelle when it went up, too. Like, surely there's a few engineering people, right?
Maybe.
Point is,
some were injured, but two were dead for sure.
You got a crew member saying, I think I'm losing my mind. Confine me to quarters. And another crew member who's lost her mind has just killed a bunch of people. Like, maybe you'd do that. I thought Pike was wild for this.
Yeah, he maybe has too much faith in his crew when they're slowly losing their minds. Like, it's not her fault, but yeah, get her in her quarters.
What's that line? Like, you can trust a person, you can't trust a drug. You can trust a Starfleet officer, you can't trust a space madness. Mm-hmm. Like, once you have space madness, like, then that you're not dealing with Ensign Uhura, or whatever she is now. You're dealing with, you know, Ensign Second Class Uhura suffering from space madness.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you. Confine her to quarters. She wants to be confined.
Yeah.
She's afraid. Help her out.
Yeah. Pike, anyway. A little too trying to be Captain Nice Guy. A little too much, I think.
Here's something that blew my mind. They have access to Ramon's personal logs, medical files, so Pike decides to go through them and see if there are any clues to what's going on. I thought, based on prior episodes, you could not access personal logs without months of red tape and several admirals signing off on it.
What
I thought it was damn near impossible.
Because he was dead.
Is it posthumously? It's just free for all on everybody's personal logs?
Yeah, like Ensign Redshirt just dials, go through his pad and see if there's any weird porn on it. You know, and we can make fun of him in 10 forward. Nah,
yeah, we need some juicy goss for the funeral ceremony. Like, what the fuck, man?
Well, I mean, I think it's a difference like a security officer wanting to get into someone's records just cause versus a fleet captain. Like, maybe there's an expedited, like, there's some kind of criminal investigation, sabotage, guy lost his mind, led to death of crew members, trying to figure out what went wrong, they're dead. Like, is there, like, yeah, maybe there's a fast track for that kind of thing.
Possibly. I'm a little tongue in cheek with this, but they did just tell us it was a huge hurdle,
dude,
to overcome.
But, goddamn, start. Yeah, and this is the thing is it's like I'd be more upset, except for this is such in Star Trek's DNA.
Yeah,
because these things, like any given episode, is written by 17 different writers, and that's like truly. They would like kind of write these on some of them respect scripts and people or whether they've read the technical Bible was all over the map. So like this does happen in Star Trek. I always like it when they avoid it. But yeah, I think that the captain requesting a dead crew person's decryption when they're investigating a crime is a little bit different than a junior lieutenant security officer wanting to read someone's records just cause, I guess.
Well, it was part of a legal investigation into Una, her status, right? And, like, the captain's log and when he knew what he knew and all that stuff.
Well, yeah, because, like, I guess you're saying when you're talking about treason against the Federation, that would also be something that would...
high crime?
That would fast-track a request to open up someone's logs.
You would think so. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Anyway, yeah, you might be right. It might be a posthumous and emergency thing.
I'm just trying to square that circle.
Yep. And then we go over to Lon, who strikes up a conversation with Kirk. And it gets pretty personal pretty quickly. You know, I get that from Lon's side, certainly. But Kirk's just opening up left and right. He's talking about his relationship with his dad as a kid and how it's affected him as an adult and with Sam and all this stuff. And then Lon, you know, kind of, I don't know, tries to make him feel at ease a little bit here and then excuses herself to go finish her rounds. And Kirk reminds her about that drink he owes her.
Yeah, I like how they're playing this just right. Like when she sees him in the corridor the first time, you can tell it's like affecting to her. But she's also fucking Lon Noonien Singh, and she's not going to like fall apart or cry in a corridor. But like you can tell like this takes a lot out of her. Like this...
She cares about him.
She's fallen in love with this guy, and he doesn't even fucking. And also the fact that like he every time she sees him, he seems like such a great dude. Like he remembered her name, remembered like you know her face, and in fact that they did set up a date at one point, and he's kind to strangers out of the goodness of his heart, and she's like, God damn it!
But she's probably also super worried that if she develops any kind of relationship with him, she's going to let slip.
Up.
Yeah, well the experiences they had, right? The temporal cops are up her ass, probably watching her every second of every day,
and
literally.
You could legitimately fuck up a timeline. You know?
So she's kind of deathly afraid of getting close to Kirk, but in this moment, she kind of brushes up against it.
Yeah. I wonder if she could play, like, how cool she could play it. Like, if she just, like, goes through and meets Jim Kirk at the Starbase for drinks, because that's something I could do as a Starfleet lieutenant. And did a temporal cop show up and be like, where the fuck do you think you're doing? You gonna have drinks with this man?
Hey, look, well, I'm not, you know,
it's
anything.
Like I didn't manipulate the timeline, dude. It's a, he just is supposed to, I don't know. I don't know how they'd feel about that.
He has drinks with everybody. There's nothing strange about this. Nothing. Yeah.
That's a really funny thing. She's not even the first Starfleet lieutenant that he's had a time traveling relationship with. It's awkward.
Yeah.
He's got three other Starfleet officers with similar either he's dated them in the future past or they dated him, and it's complicated.
The hilarious thing would be if we later get an episode that shows us that Kirk has also had the same experience where he's gone forward in time or something and had a whole thing with Lon, and they're both hiding it from each other.
Right. Yeah, I think Lon's doing a better job since he's just nakedly setting up dates and stuff. But yeah, that would be funny.
He's had the talk with the cops. He's been like, it's just a drink. Means nothing. I'm
talking to the man that beat the Kobayashi Maru simulation. You think these temporal cops are going to give me? No. I'll just update a couple temporal records in their database and beat him in fourth dimensional chess. And Bob's your uncle. We're fine.
All right. Una and Pelio are working on the refinery. And it's almost back online now that nobody's sabotaging it. Pelia asks what Una's problem is. And Una calls her a space hippie. And so Pelia says she's got a stick up her ass. And then Una fires back again. And Pelia says, fine, I'll have the station online in a few hours. She's just kind of tired of arguing, I think, at that point.
I actually like this scene. I thought it looked like Rebecca Romijn is having a lot of fun playing the stick up her ass character that trying to be prim and proper, but then when Pelia is like, just yeah, let me have it, she just like, it's with before the words are even out of her mouth, she's just launching, you don't respect authority and you're sloppy and you're unprofessional and are those crumbs on your uniform, like this, like it goes from like okay, these are pretty to like shades of Spock wanting to end Kirk last episode for not bussing his table, right? Like you know, some petty shit, and which let's Pelle understand it. Like, this isn't about me. This is about something else.
Yeah.
Which is kind of annoying because, honestly, I could see someone being infuriated by her just on the things that, like...
The space hippie aspect?
Yeah.
Or
the space hippie, yeah. That's. I also like the fact that Pelle took, like, so much offense to that, you know? Like, she's been called a lot of things, but...
I've never. Yeah.
Space hippie? Ugh.
And the final, you know, shot that Una fires here, I think it's interesting. I want to ask you if it hits home, why it's accurate. But she says, you've been in Starfleet before I was born, and yet I outrank you. Why is that? And it's meant as an insult. Like, you are sloppy. You don't take anything seriously. You're just kind of fucking around out of here. The rest of us are trying to get stuff done. Why isn't she higher ranked if she's been around for potentially thousands of years?
I think it's because she doesn't care. Like, that's not like she's in this as an intellectual and like relational building thing. It's not like she was super passionate about engineering the majority of her life in the 20th century or 21st century. She didn't know anything about engineering. So it's like, I really think she's just kind of a vibes person. And she probably doesn't want to be like, is there anything about Pella that indicates that she wants command?
No.
This is probably the highest rank she can get away with in Starfleet without being like slapped behind a desk or like going to have to order people to their deaths or some shit that's not fun at all. Those aren't vibes.
And you would usually have a ton of autonomy, I think, as the chief engineer, right? I mean, look at Scotty. Scotty's always just running around the ship doing his own thing until there's a desperate emergency and he's got to like fix something that's broken in a certain amount of time. But other than that, he's just kind of doing his own thing. He's not going out on away missions. He just doesn't have much to do.
The only time people are up your ass when stuff's broke. If stuff's running like a top, then you're probably left alone.
A lot of freedom in that role. It's probably what she likes.
Yeah.
Although, less freedom on the flagship, I would think, than some podunk ship out in the middle of nowhere. So what's she doing here? She also likes the prestige, I guess.
Kind of wild that she ended up, maybe she really likes teaching, but like the thing that doesn't square with me is her teaching at Starfleet Academy, because I feel like that's the least freedom. Like, you're almost not even in Starfleet at that point. Like, you're not exploring the galaxy. Yeah. You're preparing other people to do the thing that you, so like it's kind of wild that she lasted as long as she did in
It's kind of wild that they let her be chief engineer after hijacking the Enterprise. That's kind of wild. No reprimand for that whatsoever.
Yeah.
Because it all turned out okay.
Yeah, Starfleet's a little kind of piratical that, like, the ends justify the means sometimes, you know?
Yes. All right, Kirk watches Ramon's personal logs. Again, he's just got a pad. He's just watching it on his iPad in Uhura's quarters or whatever. Personal logs! Personal logs. Anyway, based on those logs, Uhura realizes she doesn't have much time until she loses her mind. Kirk tries to cheer her up with a cookie and a joke, but it's poorly timed. And then they have this conversation about how Uhura says she's always struggled with the weight of her family's death, and Himmer's death kind of brought back all these issues with it. And Kirk tells her to stop trying to forget the memory of those people and instead hold on to them and thereby reclaim them from death. So he leaves and she watches Himmer's tutorial again and has an epiphany that we'll get to here in a sec.
Yeah, this is another one where I felt like this is not quite connected, because she talks about how she is so loath to see, you know, to go back and revisit memories of the people that she's lost that she cares about. Yet the episode opens with her watching Himmler and smiling and kind of being nostalgic on her iPad. It's like,
yeah, the little like smile she gives earlier doesn't quite work.
Yeah, like one of those scenes should have been rewritten or cut. And that's another one where it's like not everything, it's a little Pella-like in the craftsmanship of this episode. A little sloppy, some crumbs on some writer shirts, I think.
Instead of smiling at the end of that scene, she should have like steeled herself to open the video. That's what should have happened.
Yes,
she should have been visibly distressed.
Or maybe even have the computer. Can you send this through a speech synthesizer and spit me out of like a text? So she's so uncomfortable she can't watch it.
Yeah,
they didn't tell that story. And I gotta say this, I've found a lot of the speechifying on this show to be surprisingly good, especially when how bad it got in Picard sometimes.
Oh yeah,
I think this Kirk speech is like word salad. About letting death not win, and you don't let death win by remembering your people real hard. And if you try to what the fuck? Like, okay.
She's actively trying to forget these people by not thinking about them, right? And so death has claimed those memories. But if she can remember them fondly, remember, you know, not how horribly they died in shuttle accidents, but remember the good times with them, she's able to reclaim that from
death.
Like
I said, the general advice of like you need to deal with your feelings and your grief and you can't just keep putting it off is sound. It's just the way he expressed it and the metaphors were. Mm-hmm.
Well, he had cookie on the brain. He was thinking about that big old chocolate chip cookie.
I always think it's cute in these series when they make it seem, and it might be correct, that there is subtle differences between the replicated versus like, you know, things that are home cooked, like Picard always, you know, had this grousy thing about the caviar. This is never as good as the real caviar. The synthesized caviar is just never the same. And here Kirk's saying like, oh, these aren't just replicated cookies, they're fresh baked in the mess. Like, I think that's cute that, you know, replicators are not the perfect end all be all that we think they are. They struggle with some things.
I also like that Kirk is kind of struggling to relate to what Uhura is feeling in this scene, because like this cookie thing, does he really think, I mean, maybe this is what James Tiberius Kirk thinks of most women, but he thinks a cookie is going to cheer her up when she thinks she's losing her mind. Like, what kind of child do you take this woman for?
She just
sets him straight immediately there.
Have the potential to cheer up any human, regardless of their mental state, and it's a worthy thing to try.
If Uhura had just shown up to that nacelle where Ramon was with a cookie, it never would have blown up.
I think he handled it pretty good. There's one other thing I wanted to say. The other thing about Kirk giving this speech about you need to accept death and like this is the guy who cheated so he didn't have to deal with the whole fucking Starfleet exam on dealing with unwinnable conditions and death. This is the last guy that should be lecturing people on.
And then if you can't prevent death, you learn how to deal with it.
I guess. Yeah. I don't know. Because his whole thing is like Kirk doesn't want to admit defeat and it blows up in his face. And like this is a weirdly more emotionally mature version of Kirk. And I guess what I don't know if it's like it's them like being a little bit sloppy Joe or if it's like they're like, well, it's 2023. We can't have 1967 Captain Kirk. We're going to have to like make him a little bit less of a wild man, but I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, Uhura has an idea and takes Kirk over to Sam to get some help. Sam pulls out a theory about extra-dimensional life forms attaching themselves to atoms from our dimension and that they might have attached themselves to the deuterium atoms in the nebula. And Uhura thinks that they're using her thoughts to say that refining the deuterium is killing them and or torture.
Yeah.
Sam for sure hosts a series on Uhura Tube about extra-dimensional aliens, right?
I mean, he's going to write a whole paper on it. Why not?
Yeah. That mustache is just an affect he does for Uhura Tube.
Yeah, no, like I said, this stuff was pretty cool. I like the idea that, you know, these are extra dimensional beings. And I think what they're trying to get here is like the whole idea of you've, you know, like try to understand extra dimensional beings is like, imagine you live on a piece of paper and you're a two dimensional stick person and someone draws a line in front of you and that's a wall to you. But like as a third dimensional person above the paper, that line is not a wall. You can cross over that just by going around or above. Or like, what would it look like for a three dimensional sphere to pass through this two dimensional person's space? And it's like, you'd first see a point when the sphere just touches their dimension and it would slowly get bigger circle until you're right at the full diameter of the circle. And then as it continues to pass through that plane, it would get smaller and smaller and smaller and disappear. And that would look like a phenomenal supernatural event to that person on 2D space. And the thing is that kind of gets you an idea, but like we have no idea what it would look like for a fifth dimensional being to penetrate three dimensional space. Like it kind of gives you an idea of like it would look weird and wild, but we don't know. And they're postulating that this would be something that's invisible and imperceptible, but still somehow has effect on our matter, entangled in our matter. And they're getting sucked into these scoops and getting ripped apart in the engines. I thought it was a cool idea. And then the whole universal translator, you know, that they are beaming these intense psychic feelings and emotions and like the universal translator, which I guess works this way. I don't know that they've ever talked about it, that it, you know, there's commonalities in the way beings communicate ideas and it lights up certain sections of sentient beings' brains. And those patterns can be analyzed by the computer to like detect speech. Like it's not even like, it feels like the universal translator would work like almost on a mental connection, but I don't know. It might just be they haven't really thought that through. But the idea that these aliens are so powerful or they're so inexperienced that they're literally, it's like pumping in too much wattage through a, you know, a communication device, just burning it out. Like their speech centers and their brains are getting destroyed, driving them crazy. I thought that stuff was really solid sci-fi stuff.
Yeah, because they're screaming at the top of their lungs saying, stop this, you know?
Right. And maybe they haven't the whole time, but like, you know, they've been trying to shut this thing down for weeks, months, and now they're getting to where they're screaming. Yeah.
So Uhura takes the matter to Pike. She calls him, tells him he has to shut down the refinery, which apparently went online 5 minutes ago. It's not responding to shutdown commands. So Uhura fights her way through the visions to make it to the bridge where she explains the situation to Pike. She tells him they have to blow up the refinery. So they do. And That's it. Pike says he'll take the blame and then sends Uhura to bed.
I liked how the indicator of success was zombie hammer. Yeah. Like he's on the bridge. And as soon as they blow up the gas station, he's just like regular hammer with like a thumbs up.
Yep. Just like
the
smiling,
contrast
nodding.
Was funny. Did it look like Pike was a bit taken aback of Uhura taking command over the Enterprise's weapons batteries? And
There are a couple of things that are strange like that in this scene. For one, yes, he's like a little dismayed that she's giving orders over a fleet commander here to his ship, but so what, right?
You have to sweat. There's a couple ways that I wouldn't be bothered if they didn't cut the Pike and have him go like, God damn, she's firing my photon torpedoes now. I wouldn't think much of it because, like, I don't know. Or if he'd said, like, Ensign, I'm sure this will be a relief to you. I'm letting you give the order. But, like, I think it's a big deal for a junior officer to be firing off photon torpedoes in front of the commander and his.
Especially when this decision is a big one, right? Like, Starfleet is counting on this outpost, not just for fuel, but for surveillance of the Gorn territory.
Also, if he's like, wanting to take, like, the full credit or full blame for it, like, maybe that's what they're saying, is, like, that this makes sense of him saying, hey, don't worry about it, I'm going to take on all responsibility. But, like, yeah, I thought, if they filmed it this way, like, Pike is bothered or, like, raising his eyebrows, it should have been addressed, or they shouldn't have gone there. It's my opinion on it.
Yeah, I was also a little disappointed that when Uhura's like, we need to blow up the refinery. Yes, I'm sure about that. We're killing them. You know, Pike asks her, are you certain of this? She says, yes. I've never been more certain of anything in my life. And then Pike looks to Kirk, and Kirk gives him a nod. And I don't like that. Like, I want him to trust Uhura over this random fucking lieutenant that is not even part of his crew. Like, Uhura, not go get, like, Kirk to verify. I mean, I know she's in a compromised mental state and
that's
Kirk is not,
thing.
But like, you're either going to believe her or you're not. You're not going to fire torpedoes based on this if you don't
commander.
Believe her.
You just heard that there's life forms 30 seconds ago. This person is suffering from space madness. I didn't take it as like an in-group, out-group, a man, woman, like, oh, it's more of like, this is a crew member who is suffering from an intense delusional state. And maybe before I launch torpedoes at the station that could be crucial to the Gorn war effort, which again, Gorn are pretty fucking bad, you know?
Oh yeah. Nasty.
Yeah. I guess that made sense to me. I didn't have a problem with it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
But if you
Kirk
interpret
has more
it as
facts
him,
than
like,
he does too, right? Like, Kirk knows, Kirk's had all this explained to him more than 12 seconds ago and has thought about it. And Pike just doesn't have the info he needs to make the call. So he goes to the next most rational person.
Although, like, yeah, like, he's the cowboy. So it's like, yeah, like, you're if you're looking for Jim Kirk to say no to blowing shit up, you're probably not going to get, he's probably not going to be that break very often.
He doesn't hate the Gorn enough yet. Mm. He will.
Wait till he's forced to kill one with a bamboo bazooka. That's going to cement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those Gorn didn't look nearly as scary as the Gorn we got now.
No, they're going to look kind of hilarious in retrospect.
The chubby slee stack looking
with
Gorn
the polka dot
from the
uniform.
Original series.
Yeah.
Yeah. not super. Those guys are splitting dudes open, laying eggs inside of them, turns out.
Apparently, who would have known? Anyway, yeah. The other thing I like about this scene is Pike is taking a very extreme action here, potentially with massive consequences to himself, and he'll never know if he made the right call. There's no evidence that he could point to that says this was the right call or not.
Well,
he's just got to take it on faith.
The other thing I thought is, like, okay, if using a Bessard ram scoop and refining them is painful, what is setting off three photon torpedoes going to do to them? What is unleashing the destructive energy of the very creation of the universe in the middle of their home going to do? Like, that's just, that's a gentle massage.
Yeah, I do wonder how reactive the deuterium is, how unstable it is, right? Will this, like, set off the entire nebula and oops, they've just genocided these beings?
Dude,
or
I don't know.
Is deuterium pretty stable until you put it through the refining process and then into the engines?
It's, well, but what does even stable mean? Because to me, it's like
it won't cause a chain reaction.
I bet that, but like exploding, that is going to move that deuterium around. I don't know. I just thought it was a little bit funny that like
yeah. And why
maybe
do you
just
have
one
to
last
up
big
the entire...
ouch, and then it's over. It's over and done.
Sure, it's like
ripping
a
off the
ripping
Band-Aid.
Off. Yeah. It's like using a dermal regenerator on your nose. the other thing is, why did they have to blow up the refinery? Because it was the most expeditious way to do this. Couldn't they have just like cut the power to it so it stopped running?
They said it wasn't responding. So I think they if I take it at their word that they tried everything they could have.
Yeah, so phaser of a plasma conduit or some shit. Like, you don't have to blow the entire
full
damn
photon
thing up
torpedo
to stop
spread
it
at it. Yeah, beam back on the station and shut it down manually. But if you're killing and torturing people,
just more evidence that Pelia is sloppy. Pelia is a space hippie.
Well, I'll say this: I actually liked it. I actually liked that Pike was so quick to like, oh, I have a credible report to my crewmen that we're killing new life and new civilizations. Fucking shut it down! And it, like that
That's
is
the
such,
most important thing, right?
It's yeah, like it's like get back. This is the Federation I recognize that will sometimes take short-term losses to preserve and protect the ideals that they cherish. And you know, as they made this point many times this episode, like, what's the point of going out and finding new life and new forms if you're, you know, your very act of exploration or exploiting this nebula is destroying it? Like, I like that, and I like the Federation. The Pike was so quick to like, even though this is so important to the Federation. So is it, you know, like in like, you know, real politic, is it kind of insane? Yes. But I like that's, you know, 300 years in the future that we're that reflexively protective of something fragile and beautiful and unique and living and innocent. I think that's cool. That's the Star Trek that aspirational message appeals to me.
All right, next scene, Una tells Pelia that the C that she got as her student in Starship Maintenance 307 is why she's angry at her. But Pelia says, nah, it's because I remind you of Himmer's death, which is much more spot on. Una recognizes that, yeah, she's actually not mad at her for the C.
Do you think it does kind of blow my mind that Una Chin Riley got a C in engineering because she wrote a sloppy paper? That seems very... Mm-hmm. But it could be that, like, she's talking about sloppy in the terms of your thinking. Like, I think you could characterize Una's thinking in terms of troubleshooting as sloppy. Like, you're laser focused on the problem in front of you, and you're not getting a big picture, which would suggest she hasn't grown much as a crew member. But I don't know.
Well, she's not an engineer, right? Like, she's in logistics. She's not in science.
But Pike put her on this job because she's so meticulous and organized, and yet
he thought it was an organizational issue that was a problem, and she's working with the chief engineer. So I think like, yeah, I think Pelia's here is the one who's like supposed to be really repairing this, but Una is kind of taking over from a logistics perspective.
Yeah.
Because she doesn't like Una, because she reminds her of Himmer.
Yeah, I still don't know that I buy that this particular person wrote a sloppy engineering paper.
Yeah. Yeah, it could just be she didn't write the engineering paper that Pelia liked. Anyway, Uhura and Kirk share a drink. Sam congratulates Kirk on his promotion, but when he expects an apology in return, he doesn't get one and he storms off. And then Spock is introduced to Kirk by Uhura, and they all three kind of sit down. All three members of the crew that we're going to recognize, minus Chapel, from the original series, are here.
Star Trek cringe. It's a weird bit. Way to play the scene to have Uhura look at them shaking their eyes and be like, ah, fuck yeah, they're shaking hands. Like, that's
the moment I've been waiting for, right?
Again, that's like, this is the whole make the ship go. Like, there's things that we as a fan, like, yeah, you see that, huh? That I don't know that it's appropriate for the care. Like, why would Uhura, like, I mean, there's a satisfaction of like, I like this guy, I like this guy, they'll probably like each other, I'm putting them together. But like, it was like this kind of knowing, like, fuck yeah, it's Spock and Kirk shaking hands, and I just thought it's
the
like
moment.
It border, like it's they didn't make it a very big moment, and the way they made it a big moment is have one crew member who shouldn't be like, huh, get it, viewer, huh? This is a big momentous thing happening, and like, I don't know, feel a little weak.
Next episode, Uhura goes to the future, sees the Spock Kirk Enterprise, comes back now, and she's avoiding the temporal cops, but she's slyly putting them together.
Yeah. That's just true. They can the temporal cops can fix a lot of problems with some of these.
Every single
issues.
Crew member has had an experience with every other crew member in the future, and they can't talk about it. That's what's happening here.
Yeah. What would be the funniest thing for Uhura to flash forward to? Her kissing Kirk on the gladiator planet, her doing the naked fan dance, her trying to bluff her way through a Klingon checkpoint. Like,
oh, God.
So many great Uhura moments.
Yeah. It did feel like a big moment to me as an audience member, but maybe not with the rest of the episode. I like the way that they end this episode. You know, they kind of sit down, they're clearly going to talk, share a drink, and then the camera just kind of drifts away as some jazz music plays. I thought it was an appropriately toned final thing to leave this episode with. But overall, it felt a little misplaced.
It's weird because it's the kind of grace note you usually get at the end of a season. That's what it felt to me like a big closing of a chapter. It's like very classy, the slow pull out through. Are they calling this? What is the name of this fucking bar?
I don't know. I don't know what the TOS bar is called.
All right. Turns out I looked it up. It's called the Port Galley. I don't know if they've named that on the ship, or if it did, it's probably something that Pike just threw off. But it implies there's an aft galley.
Yeah.
Or I'm sorry, starboard galley?
Starboard galley.
It's got to be more than one galley on Enterprise. But yeah, I think it's a cool... seems like a massive upgrade over 10 forward.
An upgrade?
I think so.
Oh,
I
don't know.
I thought 10 the forward view. Looks like a big conference room. It has great view.
Yeah. I mean, they were working with 80s technology.
Yeah, it's all that 80s set hotel dressing. Lobby looking shit.
Because the original series bar does not look like an upgrade in any way.
Yeah. Did they have one?
Uh-huh. Yeah. A couple of times they used that. I remember in the Tribble episode.
Yeah, right. That. Like, and in Space Matt, because I remember a fight breaking out between Chief Scott and somebody.
Yes. I think that was in the Tribble episode. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. That was enough. That was just a closet. That's a broom closet of Desilu that they threw some Art Deco shit into. All right, I forgot what we're... But the ending of this was... It's because it's treating it as a big moment.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a big moment.
Yeah.
It's a weirdly anticlimactic big moment.
But that's it. That's the end of the episode. Shields up. Here come the ads.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
At ease, Ensigns. Welcome back to Baldly Go.
If you would like to send us feedback, you can do so at StarTrek@baldmove.com. Several people took us up on that offer. Let's consider their feedback, Jim. Nicole K. is first, says, loving your coverage of Strange New Worlds. I do have a quick question. Aaron mentioned something about Vulcans aging more slowly than humans. If that's the case, wouldn't Spock's mother be much older? I was also recently watching the old movies, and she didn't look to be much older than him in those two. How old do you suppose Spock is supposed to be in Strange New Worlds? So I was wrong. I thought Spock was like 60s, 70s, 80s to Kirk's 30-something in the original series. And it turns out I'm wrong. They're both Kirk and Spock were born. I think Spock is 3 years older. And because he was born in like 2260 and Kirk was born in 2263. And they are I think Spock would be in his late 20s, maybe 30, and Kirk would be like 26, 27.
Okay.
So they're very young people. And I guess I buy Amanda Grayson being fit, you know, like, you know, with 23rd century technology being in her early 50s. Yeah, hell, she's 40, like 42 in real life. So it's like, it's not that big of a stretch. Yeah. Gnarl says, in reference to your brief discussion about the models versus CG in Star Trek, I have been checking out the old series on Paramount Plus in between episodes, and they have replaced all their models with horrible late 90s, early aughts CGI. It's an absolute travesty and kind of hurts the eyes. Practical effects are forever. That stuff is for never. You know what he's talking about? Because I've seen these remastered Star Trek episodes.
The original series? Or
yes.
Oh, I haven't seen the original remaster.
I'm going to try to find one that I, because like I remember seeing these for the first time a couple years ago, and I remember thinking they looked good because the old models looked bad in some cases. And there's an episode about it with a Romulan warbird, and I remember thinking the Romulan warbird looked a lot cooler than I remembered it. But it might be, it's been like maybe 10 years, so maybe they, because that's the thing. Like, you look at special effects on television shows even 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Holy hell, there's a huge gap between movies and TV. And nowadays, I don't fucking know. I don't know that I've ever seen a movie as good looking as like Foundation or I don't care for the show itself, but I thought that the Lord of the Rings thing, the Amazon, is like it had some jaw-dropping looking things. There's no difference between movie and television effects at this point. Maybe they need to remaster it.
There you go. Every 10 years, we can just remaster all of Star Trek, except for DS9, which they're apparently never going to fucking touch. That 4x3 aspect with the bad...
Dude, you can't get the original 35mm, because like those are problems. there's problems with 35 millimeter scans, and that like if you do them widescreen, sometimes like you'll see mic booms and shit because that wasn't intended to wait. But like you can't get it's just a shit broadcast quality.
Yeah, they've never remastered those. Even on Paramount Plus, they haven't done what they did with like TNG.
I imagine Voyager got the same treatment because that wasn't high def.
That would be a travesty if Voyager got remastered and DS9 did not.
Deep Space Nine needs to get.
Yes.
I wonder if they just threw away the 35 millimeter because like that should be an easy project. Just fucking scan the 35 millimeter tapes. I mean, for something the size.
It's expensive to rescan stuff at high resolutions, and there's a lot of it. It's not just a movie, right? It's like seven seasons of 26 episodes each. So hundreds of hours of that.
Mark says, you were talking about the relevance of Kirk and the old series to today's newer Star Trek fans. I'm a longtime Trek fan. I was a young kid in the 60s during the original broadcast of the old series, so I've grown up with Trek. Longtime fans, by necessity, have a particular point of view regarding the old show, given that they've experienced the show and it's all our incarnations. That kind of blinds them to how new viewers would view the old series. However, I vicariously have been able to experience seeing the old series for the first time by watching reaction videos of younger viewers, typically millennials on YouTube. There's one YouTube channel in particular that I've been watching, Target Audience, that has a mission of watching all the Trek content in release order. They started with season 1, episode 1 of the old series.
Okay.
Of course, the Man Trap. And they're currently in the middle of the run of the animated Star Trek series, which ran from 73 to 74. The two guys running the channel have been asked multiple times about what surprised them most about the show, given its age. They both agree what surprises them the most is just how well the old series stands up today's world. Obviously not the acting styles or the production values. They recognize it's a 60s show after all, but what stands out to them specifically are the compelling character relationships and the many, but not all, of the compelling storylines in the episodes. They even found certain episodes to be very relevant to today's society, for example, season 3's Let That Be Your Last Battlefield. They quickly caught on to the special relationship of the Big Three, of course, Kirk, Spock, McCoy, and for them, this really became a hallmark of those older episodes. My point here is I wouldn't necessarily be quick to dismiss the relevance of the old series to the first-time modern viewers. Obviously, they didn't ever go out of their way to watch it. They'll have no idea how significant the show is to current character relationships and newer shows, but I wonder how many new viewers will go back to watch the old series to see what was just a big deal with that show. I mean, you're not wrong, and as an old series enjoyer myself, again, I was a Star Trek fan just like 2 or 3 years before The Next Generation came out, so I was already a big fan of particularly the movies. I'd seen most of the old series, because it wasn't exactly as easy as just dialing up Netflix to watch it back in the day. But I'd seen all the movies and most of the series, and I'd read a bunch of the novels, and then Star Trek The Next Generation came out. And you're right. Like, what's great about the old series is the chemistry between, you know, DeForest Kelly, Leonard Nimoy, and William Shatner, and how they interplayed as their characters. And it is, in my mind, I know that Jim fights me over this, but then he's not seen all the old series. I think it's the best. I think that's the best bridge crew. In terms of like the big three, like the Next Generation, yeah, it's not a big three, and I think that's special and unique.
It's a big two.
And no, it's like what's the big
Picard
three?
And Riker.
Really? You don't think Data? Because I think I find it hard to separate Picard, Data, Riker, Geordi, Troy, Worf.
Oh, it's a big seven,
and Beverly. Yeah, I do. I do think that that's the fucking bridge crew. And it's like, it's hard to imagine how dominant the Holy Trinity was back in the old series. But that's the way. But like you know, these millennials, you know, obviously they're doing this for content, and you know, they had a. I just think it's if people want to go back and watch it, I think it's great, and they'll probably be rewarded. Especially if you give it a season to kind of fully acclimate. But it's also a big ass to have somebody go back and watch these rough old shows, you know?
That's the thing that always strikes me, is like how few younger people will actually do that. I think if they did, they'd probably appreciate it in the light that you want them to appreciate it in. but also they're just not gonna, because there's so much new content, even in just Star Trek, even in this franchise alone, there's plenty of new content to keep them busy. I don't think it's a matter of like they won't enjoy what they're seeing. It's more a matter of when will they ever have the opportunity or the incentive to go view it.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of like, it's like, yeah, that's the thing. It's like, I'm dealing with the fact that like, I really want to watch The Godfather of my son, but I know he'll think it's a boring piece of shit right now. So yeah. I'm going to have to wait until like he's at least 23, 24 before I even try it. And it's like, he's 30 years older than I was. And it was kind of a big ass for me to go back to watch this old movie. You know, I think it's now my favorite movie of all time, but like, there's going to be a point where The Godfather is so old and so unrelatable that even though it's going to be like, the Citizen Kane, like, oh, it's a brilliant movie, but like, it's nobody's favorite. Right. And I think that's where the old series is at right now. It's great for its time. Very nostalgic. But and there are going to be people that, like, you know, there's 16-year-olds right now discovering Casablanca and thinking it's the greatest thing since sliced. But those are exceptional people. Not that they're great. It's just that they're at the extreme ends of the bell curve of being able to appreciate. And it's a big ask. And I always think when I meet someone that is able to appreciate that stuff, I think, oh, wow, that's really cool. Rather than like, why don't all these whippersnappers appreciate how amazing Forrest DeKelly was when he'd cock his eyebrow at something stupid Spock said, you know, or calls him a green-blooded Vulcan or what, you know, like if you can't appreciate that, good for you. If not, I totally understand.
I'm getting an itch, man. I'm getting a Star Trek itch. I don't know if you know what this feels like, but I'm almost done with my DS9 rewatch. I got about a season and a half left of that. I've been watching some good Star Trek lately. I'm feeling like I want to go back and watch some more Star Trek, fill in some of those gaps. I think it's the right call to do TOS first.
I think so, because it's a short commitment.
Voyager. I might be getting insane here, but I kind of have an itch to go fill in that gap of Voyager.
No, we talked about this offline last night, and I'm kind of feeling it too.
It's dangerous because I remember how I felt about Voyager. I'm just wondering if now 20 years, 25 years, however long it's been later, I'll be able to appreciate it more.
Well, your expectations are different. Like my expectations for Voyager when I was watching it was like, this should be right out of the gate as good as TNG and Deep Space Nine were. And that wasn't even a fair expectation for Voyager, because the Next Generation fucking sucked for all of season one, most of season two. And
but
Deep
it was
Space
contemporary
Nine,
with the tail end of a very good Star Trek series. So like, contemporary with the beginning of a Star Trek series that I think starts out the best of any of them. Deep Space Nine.
But still, I think season one is undeniably the weakest season, and there are some pretty weak episodes in that first season. And Voyager, gets their shit together after episode season two, and you know, goes on just fine. I wouldn't know because I boned out a second that Seven of Nine showed up, which I guess is kind of when this show grows out its beard, pops its collar. I wouldn't mind giving Voyager a second chance. The old series would be a lot of fun to rewatch, but
Maybe in the off season, I'll take a look at those.
All right, last email. Alan says, maybe I'm just a dirty, dirty fuckboy myself, but I've never understood this. Why do people believe that when a guy gets dumped, even if it's softened by couching it as we need to take a break, he has some kind of moral obligation to remain celibate for a period of time? Screw that. Okay. Here's the cheat code. You don't have to give a shit what she thinks unless you want to get back together with her. And like... Spock in this thing is that because if you never you're like, yo, fuck me, fuck you, then yeah, go dick down Nurse Chapel the very day your betrothed, your Vulcan betrothed that you shared a mind meld and Katra with. Do that. But like, don't expect her to be super fucking happy that your actions, which demonstrated a lack of trust and caused your fiance to be confused, asking for a break and some time to think about things. Don't ask her to do you any favors when she comes back and find out that, oh yeah, I just went on a fucking mad bender through the junior officers of the Enterprise's medical division. Like, you can have that expectation, but you will be disappointed. So yeah, like fuck yeah, like yeah, fuck T'Pring if you're Spock and you don't ever want to give a shit about her ever again. But I don't think that's Spock, so I think he's being foolish.
Yeah. No, the way he left it was like not, a fuckboy. We're done forever. And the way he left it was, we might get back together. We just need some time to think about this.
Yeah. And again, it was his fuck up too. Like, it's not like, you know, T'Pring was just like, you know, I think historically done her a little bit dirty, and he's doing some fuckboy shit, and I don't think T'Pring is a fuckboy appreciator, enjoyer, so it's probably not gonna go well. I've watched ahead. Yeah. I've seen the old series. I see how this goes.
I've seen
all
Cable
right?
Guy. I know how it goes. Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen on one episode of Futurama. That's feedback for the week. StarTrek@BaldMove.com is how you send us more. You can follow us on all social media at Bald Move, except for TikTok, which is Baldest Move. We were late to the party, and someone swiped, some seven follower account swiped in and got Bald Move. Secondly, or finally, you can also support us at support.baldmove.com if you'd like to keep us going. Over half of our operating income comes from direct listener support, so we do depend on people thinking what we do here is of value. So if we made you smile, made you laugh, have been your constant companions for several seasons of quality television, check it out, support.baldmove.com, because you can start skipping ads and you get a whole bunch. There's even, believe it or not, even more podcasts with us in it, exclusive for club members. support.baldmove.com. We will be back for next episode when episode 7 drops. StarTrek@baldmove.com for the feedback, and otherwise we'll see you then next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.